is Tuesday, January 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, as President Donald Trump praises the protesters in Iran, we get perspective on the demonstrations.
What we're seeing is basically the working classes, the poor, in a kind of a haphazard, not necessarily organized fashion, lashing back.
California legalizes the sale and use of marijuana, and radiologists have a new tool to detect breast cancer. It's all ahead. U.S. President Donald Trump praised Iranian protesters Tuesday, saying they were finally acting against the brutal and corrupt regime in Tehran. Trump contended in a Twitter comment that all of the money that his predecessor, former President Barack Obama, so foolishly gave Iran as part of a 2015 international agreement to control Iran's nuclear weapons development program went into terrorism and into their pockets. Earlier, Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, said in a statement shown on state television, in recent days, enemies of Iran used different tools, including cash, weapons, politics, and intelligence apparatus to create troubles for the Islamic Republic. The persistent anti-government protests across Iran continued into Tuesday, with the death toll surpassing 21 since the demonstrations first erupted on Thursday. President Hassan Rouhani, who has appealed for calm, acknowledged Monday many people are frustrated over a lack of economic opportunity despite a two-year-old nuclear agreement that was to lift sanctions, as well as desire for more freedom. Hussein Banai is an assistant professor at Indiana University. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the government in Tehran is having difficulty in responding to the spontaneous unrest, in part because the protesters are not the same as those who have taken to the streets in the past.
Usually clashes with the security services featured university students, academics, activists, people who basically have planned on demonstrating before the government and register their grievances. But now what we're seeing is basically the working classes, the poor, in a kind of a haphazard, not necessarily organized fashion, lashing back at the very local institutions of the regime in a way that's been very different from major urban area-driven protests of previous phases. So from the perspective of the regime, this is something clearly very new that they had not at all anticipated. We'll see how they deal with it. There have been various different reports of different responses by the government. They clearly don't want to make this into something that would escalate further on the part of the public and bring other parts of the population into it. But at the same time, they're seeing something new that they've never seen before. I would say that in their minds, this is a very serious threat at the moment.
Do you agree with the general assessment that this is driven by the poor economy and by official corruption?
Yes and no, in that the economy and corruption have been a standard feature of the Islamic Republic almost from the beginning of its establishment after the revolution in 1979. So economic hardship and the uneven concentration of wealth is nothing new in Iranian society. It's always been there. I would say that what is different this time around is the conspicuous way in which senior members of the regime are basically spending the public money or the newly released money after the sanctions were lifted on causes that are not at all to the benefit of the average person in Iran, but rather furthering the geopolitical interests of the regime in the region, be it in Yemen or in Syria, or spending it on further fortifying their kind of uneven concentrations of power. So the fact that this has become so conspicuous is, I think, what people are especially upset about, not the fact that the economy is corrupt and uneven.
Absent a brutal crackdown, Hussein Banai of Indiana University said there's a good chance these protests will continue since they represent long simmering grievances and the underlying demand for economic and political reform, which he believes is unlikely. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Doug Bernard. So, Doug, what's trending?
Well, you know, I spent a fair amount of time, Sarah, looking for reaction in social media to this one story that you were leading off with, Mr. Trump's tweeting about Iran, what's happening there. Of course, he's also tweeting about North Korea. In truth be told, however, a lot of the popular social media platforms in the West, Twitter, Facebook, to a lesser degree, Instagram and whatnot, are banned in Iran. And so what you're seeing is a lot of people in the West kind of reacting to what may be happening, but we're not getting a lot of information from inside Iran or certainly from North Korea. So but we will keep looking for that because, you know, some stuff is eventually going to filter out. So we'll keep an eye out for that. I wanted to mention, however, there is an item that's attracting a lot of social media attention, and it is specifically about social media. There is a popular, I guess they call him a YouTube celebrity. He's a young kid, 22. He makes videos on a daily basis and posts them up. He's apparently very popular, makes money from his videos. Well, he was apparently spending some time in Aokigahara. Aokigahara is a forest right at the foothills of Mount Fuji.
Oh.
But it's also known as the Suicide Forest because hundreds, literally, of Japanese people every year go into this very dense forest and take their own lives. So here you have this 22-year-old kid, you know, with some friends clomping around in the forest, and sure enough, they happen upon the body of a man who had hung himself. What happened, though, is they continued to film. They got right up close. It's just a horrible thing to see. And they were even laughing afterwards. There's lots of reaction very quickly. I'm here from Shibuya, Ku, Tokyo, Lauren Duca. Logan Paul is an amoral expletive deleted who could not be less deserving of his platform. Aaron Paul, who is not related but is a celebrity, how dare you? You disgust me. I can't believe so many people look up to you. Suicide isn't a joke, says Uchiha. And the fact that Logan Paul made a video when publicly posting a dead person to millions of Young's fans, et cetera, et cetera. People are very, very upset. They are taking the opportunity, however, many of them, to tweet out resources for those who may be considering suicide, thinking about suicide, you know, that there are resources and it's important for people to reach out. So it sparked a conversation. It sparked a controversy about what his career may continue to be. Just a distressing story to begin the new year.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks very much, Doug. That's social media editor Doug Bernard. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. The U.S. military confirms the killing of a soldier in eastern Afghanistan. South Korea offers talks with a rival North over the Winter Olympics. As we just heard, a blogger apologizes for a video featuring a dead body in Japan, and a Vietnamese businessman is arrested in Singapore. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
September's Category 4 Hurricane Maria, which devastated Puerto Rico, caused structural damage to the Caribbean island's Arecibo Observatory. The observatory includes a giant radio telescope and a powerful astronomical radar system. While radio telescope observations resumed days after the hurricane strike, the radar system took longer to get online and only recently resumed normal operations. Shortly after becoming operational, the radar system provided what scientists there are calling the best images to date of asteroid 3200 Phaethon. The asteroid, with a diameter of about 6 kilometers, flew past Earth at a distance of only 10 kilometers on December 16, 2017. Scientists say the encounter is the closest an object will come to Earth until 2093. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we look at new means of battling breast cancer. The sale and recreational use of marijuana is now legal in California. At the stroke of midnight on New Year's Day, California became the sixth of the 50 U.S. states, along with the national capital of Washington, D.C., to sanction pot use, even though the federal government still classifies its sale and possession as a criminal offense. Colorado, Washington, Oregon, Alaska, and Nevada are the other U.S. states with regulated recreational marijuana sales. International Edition's Lori London spoke with Chris Lindsay, senior legislative counsel for the Marijuana Policy Project. She asked him whether California regulators were ready for this big change.
Residents and those in California have actually had access, or they can legally possess, since they adopted the law through a voter initiative in November of 2016. What's changing on the first is that's when the first of the licensed businesses will start to come online that can actually legally sell to those individuals. So that's a big shift, but protections have been there for a little while.
Are they going to have retail stores, actually, where people can go in and buy marijuana?
Yeah, that's correct. That's really what is going to be most noticeable to, you know, your sort of average California consumer is, hey, now I can go to a store and make a purchase there. Now, question is, are they ready? I don't think we're going to see lots and lots and lots of these businesses up and running for a wide variety of reasons. But I think primarily it's because local communities are very much involved in this process. And, you know, they're all over the board. Some of them are embracing it and rushing to implement rules and license businesses. Others, you know, are going so far as saying, we don't want it here at all, and everything in between. And that all of that has to be sorted out for these businesses to be able to get the credentials needed to be up and running with state officials. It's a very much a moving target right now, and there are lots and lots of businesses working really hard to try to get open as early as they can.
Who will be able to buy it, and will they be able to smoke it in public?
They will be able to make purchases, anybody that's, you know, 21 or older. That's it. Just like going into a liquor store. So they, you know, they'll want to make sure that you're really of age. But, you know, we don't have a registry. There isn't something, you know, people have to sign up for in order to participate. They're not going to be able to consume it in public. There are going to be lots of rules about that. Local communities have their rules. At the state level, I don't believe there's any latitude for public consumption. You know, California is really kind of led a lot of the nation in terms of exposing people to smoke, and certainly that wouldn't be a component of this kind of law.
It would seem it's a pretty big change from a lightly regulated medical marijuana industry and, of course, the vast illegal market going to legal marijuana economy. How will that work?
Well, the transition's going to take a while. And understand that it's not that it was a lightly regulated medical marijuana program. It was virtually unregulated, at least at the business level. Now, that's not to say that it was as crazy as maybe some would try to portray it, but we're really far from where California was just a couple of years ago. And so, you know, this is a reflection of how these laws have emerged on the scene and how they changed over time. And then California sort of came back around to revisit its rules fairly late in the game. And there were a lot of states that had kind of gotten innovative in many ways. So California was revisiting that in order to get its medical marijuana program kind of up to spec. And it was in the midst of that that suddenly the legalization voter initiative started to really be kind of dominate the discussion. So right about the time California was getting caught up on medical and getting that regulatory system in place that it really should have had, now all of a sudden it's dealing with full legalization for adults. And so it really jumped into the conversation and started to get its hands around regulations, but, you know, the challenge really just kept getting bigger. And so we're just about to see things, I think, take off. And I think they've done generally a good job. To be sure, there are groups that don't like parts of what's coming along, and I'm sure there are going to be a lot of growing pains. It's a big, big transition that the state's undergoing.
Chris Lindsay, senior legislative counsel for the Marijuana Policy Project. There's new hope for ailing parts of Australia's Great Barrier Reef, assisted reproductive technology. Researchers have been capturing coral spawn and rearing millions of larvae in large tanks. The reef is arguably Australia's greatest national treasure. It stretches more than 2,300 kilometers down northeastern Australia and faces many threats, including climate change and pollution. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Professor Peter Harrison from Southern Cross University has been collecting the coral spawn off Heron Island on Australia's Great Barrier Reef. It's then placed into tanks where it matures. Millions of coral larvae are then placed back onto damaged areas of the reef that may not otherwise regenerate naturally. The larvae are put into large enclosures where their growth can be monitored. Early results are encouraging. It's estimated that 100 juvenile coral have survived and are settling into their new home. The mesh enclosures cover 100 square metres of damaged coral, and the next challenge will be covering several kilometres of reef. It's the first time the assisted breeding method has been used in Australia, and it follows a successful trial in the Philippines that rejuvenated reefs damaged by fishing. Professor Harrison says the trial on the Great Barrier Reef is going well.
What we're doing is capturing some of that coral spawn, growing millions of larvae, and then putting those larvae back into areas of the reef that don't have many living corals on them at the moment to rapidly increase the rate at which coral recovery can occur. These are the first experiments using this larval restoration technique on the Great Barrier Reef. The work is still experimental at the moment, but the results from these last experiments will help us understand how we can scale up to hectare scale reef patches in future.
The Great Barrier Reef Marine Park is about the size of Japan and is so big it can be seen from outer space. It's home to more than 3,000 types of mollusks and 1,600 species of fish. It's not only an environmental treasure, but an economic one as well, generating billions of dollars in revenue and sustaining tens of thousands of jobs, mostly in the Australian tourism industry. In the past 2 years, two-thirds of the Great Barrier Reef has been devastated by severe coral bleaching caused by warmer ocean temperatures, according to Australian scientists. The Australian government is contributing more than $310,000 to help advance Professor Harrison's reproductive research. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. Early detection of breast cancer saves lives. Breast cancer is the most common cancer in women worldwide. As VOA's Carol Pearson reports, scientists are working on finding new ways to detect breast cancer while they're studying existing screening methods to find out what's best.
During a mammogram, a technician takes an X-ray of a woman's breast that's compressed between two glass plates. A radiologist then examines the image for tumors. Mammograms undoubtedly save lives. The number of deaths from breast cancer has fallen by 30% in the U.S. since mammography was introduced in the 1970s. That's because when cancer is found early, the chances of beating it are greater. Mammograms are the best screening tools available, but they aren't 100% accurate. A mammogram can look normal even when cancer is present, and it can look abnormal even though there's no cancer in the breast at all. Standard mammograms are two-dimensional, But for the 40 to 50% of women with dense breasts, both tumors and breast tissue can show up as white masses on 2D images. Three-dimensional mammograms show a more detailed view of the breast, so women with fibrous or dense breasts may benefit from a 3D screening, says Dr. Otis Brawley at the American Cancer Society.
It might find disease that we need to find that two-dimensional does not. There are potential cons in that it has a higher cost, higher amount of radiation given every dose, every time a person has the test, as well as it may find a higher number of false positives.
Cost aside, one study involving 13 U.S. hospitals showed that three-dimensional mammograms picked up an additional 40% of invasive cancers. For an even better picture, a woman could have an automated whole breast ultrasound. During this procedure, a woman lies on her back as the ultrasound device moves in parallel rows, so no areas of the breast are missed. The exam captures between 3,000 and 5,000 images that are then interpreted by a radiologist. Dr. Megha Garg is the director of the breast imaging program at the University of Missouri Cancer Center.
This is a new screening technique. It helps detect additional breast cancers in females who have got dense breasts.
The whole breast ultrasound doesn't use radiation, so it poses less of a risk than a mammogram does. But Garg says it's not time to ditch the standard mammogram.
This tool does not replace the traditional mammogram. Mammograms are the gold standard for finding breast cancer. This helps the mammogram in those females who have got dense breasts.
Studies are underway to find out which techniques are the most effective. While North America, Western Europe, and Australia have the highest rates of breast cancer, the World Health Organization reports that almost 50% of the cases and nearly 60% of the deaths occur in less developed countries. If we could improve detection and treatment, at least 400,000 women's lives could be saved every year. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
That's our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
9 years ago, Russian lawyer and tax accountant Sergei Magnitsky uncovered a 5.4 billion ruble tax fraud scheme while auditing the Russia-based Hermitage Fund. He also found that a number of Russian Interior Ministry officials were deeply involved. For exposing this fraud, Magnitsky was arrested by Russian authorities and subjected to organized physical and psychological pressures while detained. On November 16, 2009, he died in a pretrial detention center in Moscow. Initially, Russian officials said his death was caused by cramp conditions and failure to provide adequate health care, but they later changed their story. Investigations were initiated, but all those implicated were acquitted and the charges were dropped. In 2012, the U.S. Congress passed the Sergei Magnitsky Rule of Law Accountability Act, which provides for the sanctioning of persons determined to have been involved in the criminal conspiracy uncovered by Sergei Magnitsky. In addition, the act provides for the sanctioning of individuals determined to be responsible for or to have profited from Magnitsky's detention, abuse, and death. The Magnitsky Act also provides for the sanctioning of persons determined to be responsible for extrajudicial killings, torture, or other gross violations of internationally recognized human rights against individuals who seek to expose illegal activity by Russian officials. On December 20, 2017, the U.S. Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC, designated five individuals pursuant to the Magnitsky Act. Significantly, among those sanctioned are the head of the Chechen Republic, Ramzan Kadyrov, and captain in the Chechen Ministry of Internal Affairs, Ayub Katayev, who are responsible for extrajudicial killings or other gross human rights violations against activists working to expose illegal activity by Russian government officials or individuals seeking to obtain, exercise, defend, or promote their internationally recognized human rights and freedoms. Also sanctioned are Alexei Shishinya, Yulia Mayorova, and Andrei Pavlov, who were involved in the fraud scheme originally uncovered by Sergei Magnitsky. This brings the number of individuals sanctioned under the Magnitsky Act to a total of 49 since the legislation was enacted. sanctioned persons may be ineligible to receive visas to the United States. Any property or interest in property of sanctioned persons within U.S. jurisdiction are blocked, and transactions by U.S. persons involving sanctioned persons are generally prohibited. Treasury remains committed to holding accountable those involved in the Sergei Magnitsky affair, said OFAC Director John E. Smith. We will continue to use the Magnitsky Act to aggressively target gross violators of human rights in Russia, including individuals responsible for extrajudicial killings, torture, and other despicable acts.